the most tragic parts, in my opinion, of the dark side of entrepreneurship is when the business is successful, the business owner doesn't know how to break out of some of those patterns. And it's really tragic because entrepreneurship is amazing, but it's got to have its place in your life. Otherwise, it becomes your life. And that's when you're on the path to the dark side.
I'm Johnny Page. I'm Matt Verlet. And this is the South County Podcast. Today, we're going to talk with someone who I feel like is a visionary leader in the SaaS world. And their platform that you've probably heard of has been a springboard for thousands of other companies, including my first one. Our guest today on the podcast is Clayton Mask, the CEO and co-founder of Keep, formerly known as Infusionsoft, a CRM and marketing automation platform for small businesses. Under his leadership, Keep has grown into a nine-figure company with over 350 team members serving tens of thousands of customers around the world. Clayton is someone that I think is really a champion for small business owners. He's also about to release a new version of his book, Conquer the Chaos, which comes out on March 6th. So Clayton, welcome to the show.
Hey, Matt, Johnny, thanks so much. So great to be here with you.
So I just want to set the table real quick. For anyone who's not familiar with Keep, formerly known as Infusionsoft, what's the problem you solve? Who are you helping? Just like, what's the elevator pitch?
Yeah, you bet. You know, Infusionsoft was marketing automation for small businesses. Keep is business automation. So we are small business automation, six, seven, and eight figure businesses. Small business automation includes marketing automation, sales automation, service automation, and operations automation. So it's really, it's all about automating as much of your business as you can to get the growth, profit, and freedom that's so elusive in small business.
I love it. I love it. And so, you know, we were just talking before we hit record, and I wanted to kick this off with, I guess, expanding on something that I said in the intro, where I said that the work, especially in the early days of Infusionsoft, I feel like has been a springboard for hundreds, I mean, probably thousands of small businesses that provide marketing automation solutions. And mine was one of them, right? So we had run a company called Run Your Gym. That was the precursor to my company, Uplaunch, and got connected through a mutual acquaintance to your product team, who was building a platform to help subject matter expert, you know, and we were subject matter experts in gym marketing, basically become a SaaS platform without having to become a SaaS platform. And I essentially, like, I made my first dollar on the internet on software that your company built. And so it's kind of cool to see it come full circle. So, I mean, I know it's an interesting chapter for you, but what comes up for you when we talk about you, you know, springboarding lots of companies and just kind of being the foundation that people built on?
Yeah, well, I love it. You know, we were fortunate to pioneer marketing automation for small businesses. And we got to a point where we were working with your company and some others to do just what you described. Then we kind of pivoted actually and went down market to solopreneurs. And that was not the right thing for us because our software is serious automation for serious businesses. So after some fun challenges that we went through for a few years there, a couple of years ago said, hey, it's actually not just about marketing automation. The world has changed so much. You know, everything from AI to everything that we do on our phones. And it just, we recognize that it was much more than marketing automation. Because a lot of times people will, they'll automate their marketing, but they're not actually improving their profit. They're not improving their time, their freedom. And it can be really frustrating because they're, you know, people look on the outside and they'll be like, oh, your business is doing great. You're growing. But the reality is there's chaos on the inside and there's not the kind of freedom that the business owner thought they were going to get. So we've taken on a bigger challenge to go to take Keep out to small businesses who really want to automate their entire business. And that's what we do, small business automation. I think back about what we were doing with you back then for marketing automation, and we're doing that kind of thing now for, like you said, subject matter experts that have a domain expertise, a following, their tribe, their vertical, whatever it is. And we're doing some cool things with that. Don Miller's just coming out with his Coach Builder powered by Keep platform, which is, which is really cool. And we've got a number of other that people recognize that are in the work. So fun
stuff.
That's
awesome. Yeah. And I love that it's, I mean, I don't know if lifelong is too strong of a word, but definitely it's a long-term mission for you. I mean, we were working on that stuff together 8 years ago and you had what? I mean, probably another 10 years or so in the game before that, at least.
That's right.
You
know, yeah. On it's over two decades at this point.
Yeah. That's
wild. There was about a 4 year period there where I was sort of in the dark corner, the recesses of our business where I wasn't exactly in the game. That's a whole separate story that happened. You know, when you take on, I think this is actually a really important message for SaaS founders that when you take on capital, if you under deliver then you put yourself at risk of getting fired or replaced or put in a different role. And so that's what happened. You know, when we tried to go down market to solopreneurs, the growth rate slowed and the churn increased and we were missing numbers. So I got pushed aside and I was still the CEO, which is kind of not very normal. Usually the venture-backed CEO will either get fired or quit in that situation. Mm-hmm. And trust me, it was both of those possibilities were highly likely on any given day, but I made it through that 4 years or so. And I learned some important lessons about the way you manage expectations. And there's some fine points on exactly how you have to do that when the company's getting bigger. You know, you get to $75, $80, $90, $100 million and you have to make some different assumptions and adjustments in terms of managing expectations than you do when you're a $5 or $10 million SaaS company.
Yeah. What would you say the biggest lesson about expectation management that you took from that chapter was? You know, I mean, like you say, there's a few lessons as you scale. I mean, a large portion of our listeners have aspirations to, you know, eclipse the 10 to 8 figure mark and get up into the sandbox you're playing in. Like, what should they be prepared for?
Yeah. The bigger you get, the longer it takes to make adjustments and make impacts to your revenue. And you know, revenue is the main thing that your investors are after. You tend to make assumptions about how you can impact your ARR based on where you were. But as you get bigger, you have to recognize you have to kind of build in a little bit more buffer. And it goes totally contrary to the way that we think as entrepreneurs. You know, we're aggressive. We want to like, we're optimistic. We want to believe this is going to happen. But you have to hedge and build in a little bit more buffer. And as you get bigger, you have to do more and more of that. And so it's a really odd thing. I think it's actually one of the reasons why, one of the key reasons why entrepreneurs don't make it through the later stages of growth and they kind of settle into the same kind of, you know, hey, I do my thing. I get the business to 10 million. Or, you know, I talk a lot about the ones and threes of revenue. I get my business to 30 million. Well, one of the reasons is that as a SaaS CEO, you have to account for the time it takes as the company, for more times that it's going to take as the company gets bigger in terms of making an impact on your ARR. And if you don't do that, then you end up under delivering. And it's why so many times entrepreneurs sort of settle into the same stage over and over.
It's like wildly counterintuitive as I'm listening to you explain it, right? Because on the one hand, the aggressive entrepreneur's brain is thinking, I have more resources, more people, and yep, if they've taken on capital, you're getting additional pressure to grow faster. And so you don't want to feel like you're sandbagging by, you know, right, not calling the aggressive shot. And then what you're saying is, despite all of those things that feel like advantages because the ship is larger, you have to build in more buffer to grow than you did when you were small.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the way that it plays out, by the way, if you know, for you know, SaaS venture-backed CEOs that are sitting there listening to this, usually you get pissed at your CFO because the CFO is like working to create a very manageable plan for the next year. Yeah. And you're like, no, like we can do better than that. We want to push the team to go more. And so you get into this thing where you're kind of pushing on the very overly conservative CFO. And of course, you know, your sales leader is trying to sandbag and keep the number lower and all these things. Like it's just this turmoil inside of you as the CEO. Cause you're like, no, man, we want it. Like we want to grow. We can do better. But if you don't create an internal plan that's sufficiently low and you hold yourself to a board plan that's higher, then you set yourself up for that under delivering. That's the kiss of death for VC backed entrepreneurs. Yeah.
We've had a few of those conversations, Matt. Back in-
I was just going to say, I'm laughing.
I was like, man, that sounds very familiar.
Donnie, meet Clate. I'll go call your CFO and we can commiserate. Clate, it's cool. You know, we have the same relationship.
Yeah. It's so crazy though, because I mean, it is the age old, what got you here won't get you there. But it's so ingrained in entrepreneurs. It's so ingrained in the CEO to be a hard charging, hey, you know, we're going to go after this growth. And so you don't realize as you get bigger, everybody knows that the growth rate goes down as the company gets bigger. You know that, like that part's obvious. Okay, we're not going to keep growing at 100% or, you know, whatever your growth rate was. So everybody makes that adjustment relatively easy. But it's the part about when you're trying to add on new layers of revenue or inflect the growth in different ways or make an adjustment, that's where you're coming out with a new product or, you know, some new thing you're doing and you sort of make the assumptions based on your course and speed in the past instead of how you're built for the day.
So Clay, most of our audience and clients are all pretty early stage SaaS companies. By most people's standards, pretty early stage, less than 10 million in ARR. Can you put your finger on what it is that slows down that adjustment? And just essentially, I think we're used to in the early days, I'm sure you felt this at the, you know, when you started Infusionsoft, you can make change pretty quickly. You can rapidly iterate. And it's part of, in fact, the quicker you iterate, the more likely your success is early on. And it's odd. So when I went through an acquisition, we go from a team of 25 to 250 overnight. And this was the thing, like how slow things moved literally caused me to leave the company. I just could not understand. It was such a big jump, and I hadn't experienced the middle ground, which I have since. You know, at SaaS Academy, we're in that middle ground and I can see, oh, I understand why things trend towards being slower, but it was a hard thing for me to wrap my head around. Can you put your finger on why do things move slower? How can we set better expectations? I think if the label's on the bottle, a founder is a lot less surprised when it does slow down, right? If they understand. So could you put your finger on what slows down organizations from making changes?
Yeah, it's the layers of the organization and the work that it takes to get the understanding, alignment, capabilities, skills into the people that are actually making it happen. So, you know, I use those words very carefully: understanding, alignment, skill. When you are small and it's leaders and individual contributors, it's, you know, leaders and doers, you can do it much more quickly because the leaders can see very clearly the doers and the skills that they have. They can look eye to eye. They can convey messages and understanding pretty quickly. And there is the alignment flows smoothly because there's trust. There's a proximity of working together that's very easy. Now, as soon as you put a layer in between the senior leaders and the doers, now you're not as clear on understanding. Like it takes more time. You've got to communicate that. So there's just more time in terms of building the understanding. There's more time in terms of building alignment because there's trust building to do. There starts to be a them and us. It's human nature. And then there's also the skill. When you're smaller, people tend to be more agile in their ability to do different roles. They can take things on. Whereas as you get bigger, people start to become more specialized. And it's just harder to expand the skill set or make the adjustments that you need in order to be successful with whatever thing you're taking on. So when you think about the understanding, the alignment, the skills that are required to execute a strategy change, a product change, you name it, it just takes more time. And oftentimes what happens is we underestimate that time and the investment that's required. And so then that exacerbates the problem. So I think that if you had to just say, well, put your finger right on it, it's layers of management. And so the flatter the organization can be, the faster you can move. And then as you over time, you get some other factors that add on to it. You tend to get, when you're smaller, you have more entrepreneurial people. When you're bigger, you have more organizers, systems planners. You know, they're just less agile and adept at moving quickly. So that's a factor as well. But I think layers of organization is number one. And then sort of just the maturing of an organization has process, all kinds of different things. It's just harder to make changes. It just takes a lot more time. And then we exacerbate it by underestimating how much time is required for investment.
I'd love to, before I know Johnny wants to dive into the book and has a few questions there. But before we get into that, I want to just double click on one thing that you said, because if I'm putting myself in the shoes of the people listening to this, the question on their mind is, cool, I should probably stave off as long as I can putting in that third layer of management, right? And which is something that I align with personally. But my question is, at what point do you know, like, what are the signs that you can't hold it off any longer? Do you look at it from like a number of direct reports standpoint? Are there other telltale signs in an organization? Like, when do you know it's time to bite the bullet and start?
It's really a function of organizational design principles. You know, if you get more than 10 people reporting to one leader, it just starts to become unwieldy. Yep. So if you've got a CEO that's got more than 10 people on the team, that CEO's having a rough time.
Yeah.
And so if you go, okay, well then that, let's say the CEO's got 9 or 10 people on the team. And then when those people have more than 5 or 6 direct reports, it starts to get tough. You know, in some cases the roles are similar, but if you just think about the math and the numbers of people that you can handle as direct reports and that your people can handle as direct reports, you have to start building in another layer. If the CEO thinks about his or her leaders and they get to that spot where they've got 8, 9, 10 leaders, you have to subdivide, you know, like the cells have to start to split. Mitosis has to occur. Otherwise it just doesn't work. So if you think about that organizational design principle, the math starts to tell you that when you have that rule of 10, that you start breaking that, you're going to create more problems with the inefficiency and the overwhelm and burnout of the leaders.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. So, Clint, you wrote a book called Conquer the Chaos. The first version came out in 2010, which Matt and I were commiserating how that felt like it wasn't that long ago. I mean, it turns out it's 14 years ago. And so I'm really curious.
Imagine how it feels to me.
Yeah. My video guy raises his hand and goes, I was 9. And I'm like, you're not helping, bud.
I know.
Well, I think it's such a great gift that, first off, writing a book is a labor of love. Like there is to take the decades of experience that you have in supporting small businesses the way that you have and to put it into a book that the reach that the book will have and the impact it'll have goes far beyond what you could do as a person. So I love that you've not only written the first version, but I'm very curious to hear what made you come back. What did you learn in that 14 year window that made you say, hey, you know what? I think that I got some more to add and more to say on this topic.
Yeah. You know, we've been in business about 7 years when we wrote the first version. My co-founder and I co-wrote it. And it really was our message to the world that helped us to launch marketing automation. And in a nutshell, you know, we knew, okay, as we launch business automation to the world, things have changed. And so that was the first part of it. But the second part of it, and this is not what I expected to happen. So the rationale for the book was, okay, well, we're going to be launching business automation. It's been 14 years. Let's redo the book. I went to Scott and I said, I think we should do this. He said, I think it's a great idea. Why don't you do it? Instead of co-writing it, you just write it. And the truth is there were some challenges in co-writing and I love Scott. He's awesome, but he's totally focused on the product as is our other co-founder. And so I said, okay, you got it. I'll do it. And I didn't expect once I got into it to be so enamored with the project. I fell in love with the project for the reason that you just said, Johnny. There's so many things that I've been blessed to learn and experience in over 20 years of not just being an entrepreneur, but teaching entrepreneurs, working with entrepreneurs, serving entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurship is my professional life. It's what I've done for over 2 decades. And as you both know, when you're in hundreds, if not thousands of masterminds and conferences and one-on-one coaching sessions. And when you're speaking with people and you're working with people, there are so many beautiful lessons of entrepreneurship that come over 2 decades that as I was going to do a revise, the rationale was, okay, I'll do a revised edition. It'll kind of update a bunch of things and kind of set the stage for business automation. And what ended up happening was I got so engrossed in it that I poured tons of time into it. I actually, for a long period of time, I was doing 1 week in the office, 1 week writing in a hotel room. And I wanted to create an amazing book. You know, the more I got into it, I was like, no, this isn't a 20% revision. It's about 80 or 90% rewrite. There are certainly some principles and some things from the original book, but it's not ghostwritten. It's not co-written. It is truly a labor of love, as you said, Johnny. And it's the book I wish I could have read 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And so I hope it blesses entrepreneurs' lives. I believe it will. I think the lessons that we've been blessed to learn, I think, are so important for people. And as you know, a big part of the book is just about how to avoid the dark side of entrepreneurship. There's a whole personal side to it. And then the 6 keys to success, there are 3 personal keys and then 3 business keys. So I appreciate you asking. It's not one of those things where it was like, okay, this will be a great business card for our business. It turned into something completely different. I really felt compelled to write what I wrote.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that you mentioned the dark side of entrepreneurship, and I'd love to unpack that a little bit more because we, in the early stages of a business, you learn to become the chief doer. And so you get a lot of your feeling of success from being the person that it's right. By the amount that you get done in the day. And then somewhere along the line, it changes to you leading through other people and the same dopamine hit that was happening when you got a lot of stuff done goes away. And we find a lot of founders go create chaos in the business so that they can strap on the cape. They don't know it, but I think you've depicted it perfectly by calling it the dark side of entrepreneurship. Can you talk through what does it take for a founder to evolve out of that chief doer into the leader that gets them out of the chaos? Because I think there's a whole lot of mindset. You unpack so many incredible tactics and touch on the mindset as well in the book. I kind of want to zero in on that right now. What's got to change about the founder's mindset and perspective for them to actually leave the chaos instead of exchanging one type of chaos for another?
Right. No, really well said. And you clearly have a great understanding of what happens. let me just paint the picture a little bit about the dark side of entrepreneurship for listeners to understand. The way I describe it is the dark side is not just when the business is struggling. It's also when the business is successful. And in fact, the most tragic parts, in my opinion, of the dark side of entrepreneurship is when the business is successful, the business owner doesn't know how to break out of some of those patterns. By the way, you know, Dan, in his book, Buy Back Your Time, there's a lot of similarities. I texted him after I read the book and I said, dude, we're writing a lot of the same stuff because, you know, just from a little bit different perspective. But, you know, the dark side will draw you in. It placates the ego. It causes you to get absorbed in yourself. It causes, when you're successful, to sometimes create all kinds of problems in your life and in the business. And sometimes it gets very messy. You know, we've all seen high profile cases of this, but unfortunately it happens all the time in small business. And the business is successful, and yet the business owner's life is imploding. And sometimes that happens because of the lack of balance. Other times, and I talk about this in the book, but the dark side is when, either because of success or because of struggles, the business owner's life starts to fall apart. And it turns into, in milder cases, you know, you might see it in terms of drugs, depression, sort of undermining things. In the more extreme cases, it, you know, it's death, divorce, it gets really, really ugly. So I don't talk about this lightly because it's a serious thing. And I touch on it in the book fairly heavily because I think we overlook it way too much in entrepreneurship. And if we're not intentional about it, the business is so intoxicating and it's so demanding that we will get sucked in. My message to entrepreneurs is that it's about balanced growth. It's about, you know, success. The definition of success, as I say it in the book, is balanced growth in your business and personal life that produces freedom in the form of money, time, control, and impact. But, you know, if you don't get that balanced growth and if you don't work at it, it gets ugly. So just, I wanted to kind of set the stage a little bit in terms of the dark side of entrepreneurship and what I feel compelled and on a mission to help people avoid, partly because I've flirted with it. I've seen what it looks like, how it destroys relationships and how it hurts people. I've experienced it through friends and family members that own their businesses, certainly customers, partners, you know, some high profile cases. And it's really tragic because entrepreneurship is amazing, but it's got to have its place in your life. Otherwise, it becomes your life. And that's when you're on the path to the dark side.
Yeah. I think Matt and I, one of the things I enjoy so much about running the business with Matt and having been on this journey with, and what led me to SaaS Academy, is that you are in a community full of people who are very aware of both the pros and the cons, or the dark side of entrepreneurship. And you have that community support. It's hard to go out it without one. It's super helpful to name it, to recognize that this is going to happen and it's a part of the journey, and it can produce beautiful things in you in a way that, like, very few life experiences will produce.
Yep.
But man, you need that. You know, Matt and I talk about this quite frequently of on the good days and the bad days of, like, of feeling the dark side creeping in. I'm curious. Yeah, yeah. One of the first things I noticed about the book was you dedicated this to your family, who said that they'd seen the highs and the lows of the entrepreneurial journey, and you encourage them to keep living out the family mission. One of our just like core values at SaaS Academy is that we encourage and coach founders to live an integrated life, that you don't win in the business domain at expense of the family and personal domain. How has this been for you? Can you unpack that dedication, the journey that your family's seen you go through, and how you're leading at a scale now that I think most listeners on this call would admire and hope to be at one day? And it sounds like you've held in balance winning in both domains. So can you unpack how you've matured and grown in that area?
Yeah. And I, by the way, I love that about the SaaS Academy community, because I feel the same way. And I think you guys do a great job of that. I do some coaching of entrepreneurs, and a couple of them are in your SaaS Academy. And I love the way that you coach people to do that and teach the balance. So the short of it is, my family is more important than my work. And I have to be reminded of that, because sometimes I love my work. I mean, I absolutely love it. You don't do this for over 2 decades without totally loving it. But I've got 6 kids. I've got 6 grandkids. My 4 oldest kids are married, and 3 of them have kids. So oldest has 3, second one has 2, third one has 1. And so to me, our family is, I mean, it's why I do what I do, so that we can do all the fun things that we do as a family. And to me, those things have to be held in balance. and you have to work at it constantly in order to do it because the business does require so much. So, you know, I mean, I have all kinds of different little tricks and things that I do. I actually share in the book the three personal keys. The first one is mindset. The second one is vision, but actually life vision that your business fits into. And it's, as opposed to the business vision, there's, you know, obviously that's part of it as well, but the life vision and then what I call rhythm of execution that is really about your morning, daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, annual routines that help you achieve the goals that you have in business and life. So I think what I would say, Johnny, is that the short of how I do that balance game is the three personal keys. It's getting the mindset right and cultivating it every day. It's the life vision that the business fits into as opposed to kind of the other way around. And it's what I call the rhythm of execution.
Do you see a correlation between the size of the business and the intensity and demands that it places on your personal life? Is it more intense and tougher to balance early days, later days? You know, you've gone the whole spectrum or is it not correlated like that?
It's actually more about what I call the stages of business growth. And I talk about this in the book that there's a very interesting thing that we discovered 14 years ago when we were writing the book originally. We studied the heck out of the Census Bureau data. I spent literally hundreds of hours on the Census Bureau data, and I found a very interesting pattern that emerged as we dug into it really deeply. And it's that businesses don't grow in linear fashion. They grow in stair-step fashion. That's not so new to anybody. I think most people kind of have a sense for that. Yeah. But what was really interesting is we found, and we saw it over and over in our experience with our customers, that they plateau at the ones and threes of revenue. So when you go to 100,000, sometimes you kind of get stuck there and you plateau and flatten out for a bit. And then you kind of get the growth going up to 300,000. And again, you hit that plateau and then up to 1 million and then to 3 million and then 10 million, 30 million, 100 million. And it's uncanny how common this is in businesses. And by the way, the numbers are a little different if you're doing like retail or manufacturing. But in most businesses, particularly most small businesses, this is what it looks like. And so the answer to your question, Matt, is that it's less about at the beginning or the end, or it's more about when the stages are changing. And it gets very frustrating because you plateau at these stages. And what's happening is you have to make adjustments to people, product, and process. And if you don't make those adjustments, you get stuck at those plateaus because the people who got you to that level oftentimes are not the same leaders who will take you to the next level. I say all the time, good leaders can take you two levels, thinking that's essentially a 10x growth, right? Because if you go from 100 to a million, that's two level changes. A good leader can take you two levels. A great leader can take you three. It's almost impossible for a leader other than a founder to continue leading the business through those multiple stage changes. So what happens is we get stuck and things get really hard because we didn't make changes on the people, the process and systems, the product, and our ambitions start to get outstripped by the realities of the chaos that we're in.
I feel like you're a pretty people-focused leader from the time we've spent together. Mm-hmm. How do you reconcile that, like psychologically, right? You know, the person who's gotten you two or three levels who you have a love for and they've done a great job and they're at the ceiling and you got to make a move because it's the business needs what it needs. Like, how do you reconcile that as a leader?
I love that question because I am a huge into great places to work and working with amazing teams. And the last key to success in the book is leadership. And I talk all about it. And we actually created a company and spun it out that teaches leadership to small businesses that want to go from seven figures to eight figures and beyond. So it's a very pertinent question. And it's one I take very seriously. And to be totally honest, when I started to see this, what I consider to be a business truth, I didn't want to accept it because it has some kind of dour prospects for people. It does, and I believe in people and I want to believe in their ability to grow. Here's how I reconcile it. I say two things all the time that I think are very powerful to convey the realities of fast growth business, particularly if you are a SaaS business and especially if you're venture backed SaaS. The reality is we are on fast moving trains that will run us over if we don't keep up. That's just the reality. That's the market dynamics at play. That's investment dynamics at play. That's entrepreneurial ambition at play. You name it. That is the reality. So what I say all the time is we are on a fast moving train. And if you don't keep up, the train will run you over. And I'm not doing you any favors if I don't tell you that reality. That's the truth. And then I say, hey, a good leader can take us 10x. A great leader can go three stages. And so there's no shame in if you join the company at 3 million and you help us as the leader of customer success get to 30 million. That means you're a really good leader. So what this means is you have to push yourself to grow way more than you think. And so you're helping people understand the realities of what it takes to lead this fast moving train and not get left behind. And then the second thing is you model it. And so the second thing I say all the time is I'm not the CEO that this company needs in 1 year, but you can bet by the time we get there, I will be the CEO that this company needs.
Yeah,
and that just sets the tone of I will get better and better and better. I will read books. I will be coached. I will join masterminds. I will get with peer groups. I will do what we need to do to learn and grow and get better. And then that sets the tone for everybody when you teach those two things and have those two sayings that run through your culture.
So talking about that and the book, I want to bring something up from the book that really resonated with me. And I'd love to get your take on it, right? So you talk a little bit about the Stockdale paradox in the book, right? And so I kind of summarize it in one sentence as it's a continuum, right? Or a tug of war, if you will. And on the one side, you've got this belief that exactly what you just said, right? That I can be the guy, I can be the leader, I can grow, I can win, I can do these things. And the other side, I love the words that you chose, right? Where you have to always
confront the brutal facts. The
brutal facts, right in the eye, right? Yeah. The brutal facts of what's going on. And so, you know, you alluded this a little bit in the beginning. You know, you've had an exciting ride through the years with Infusionsoft, with a lot of different, I would say, chapters in the book, so to speak. What comes to mind and when you had to wrestle with this personally, right? You had the faith on the one side that you can get the thing done. You had the facts on the other side that it wasn't quite lining up yet. Like, what comes to mind for you, man? What can you share on that?
Yeah. So that paradox of an undying belief that we will succeed coupled with confronting the brutal facts, that is entrepreneurship. That's it. You got to maintain the belief, but you can't bury your head in the sand and ignore the facts. And the trick, of course, is to use the facts as the feedback and the fuel. I love Dan Martell's F word of feedback. That's critical for entrepreneurs. Like, that is critical. That feedback is telling us what we need to improve. But instead of shying away from it or turning our noses up at it or trying to discount it or defend it, whatever it is, we actually use it as the raw material and the fuel to get better. That's the key thing. So I will tell you that just like most entrepreneurs, we got to a point as we got to about nine figures where I felt like, man, the growth was slowing. I could feel the board was frustrated with me. I was frustrated with me. And I was also kind of redlining at home with family. And I said, you know what? I'm going to get a COO to take over the day-to-day operations and I'll move into a more external CEO role. And I kind of, in hindsight, it was a confronting of the brutal facts. I wasn't leading the company's growth rate at the way I wanted to, and the way that I expected and that the board expected. And I could see that I was underperforming on those expectations. So I wanted to get that COO in place. And so there was a confronting of it, but it's a really tricky game because you kind of want to believe that maybe somebody else can do it. And then when you see maybe it's not working so well, you might have lost the opportunity. so that's, you know, that's what I personally went through. So there was a little bit of self-doubt that creeped in, but it was also not completely unfounded. You know, the facts were that, hey, this moving down market to solopreneurs and taking marketing automation to them wasn't working. And so maybe somebody else could help us to make it work. And it just took us 4 years to recognize, no, that wasn't working either. And by the way, to almost every solopreneur out there, if you are trying to go down market, beware. It's almost impossible unless you're in a tight vertical and you can go down that way. But even then, just know that you're defying the laws of SaaS when you try to go down market. And so, you know, there's just a bunch of hard lessons I learned, but there was certainly confronting the brutal facts there. And, you know, it didn't end up necessarily working out great for the business that we did that, but there were great lessons learned. And I'm thrilled with where we are today. And we probably couldn't have done it if we hadn't gone through all those tough lessons learned. So I think, kind of going back to Johnny's point about the ego, I never answered that one really clearly. our ego plays games with us, and it plays games with us when it pulls us back into the chaos because we do instead of lead, as Johnny called out. It plays games with us when we don't want to look at the brutal facts. But it also has another side where it plays games with us where we kind of want to escape the difficulty and think, well, maybe somebody else can do it, instead of just, that's a different kind of confrontation that you need to do. Let's confront the hard work and be willing to do the hard work. And if I could do it all over again, I would take, when we went through that period where we went down market and we kind of had a few years of just mess, I would have heeded the advice that Jim Collins shared with me and my team in a workshop we did with him in his office in Boulder one day. And he said, never confuse the need for a vacation with the need for a change. And I look back at that, and what I needed was a little bit of a vacation. I needed a few months to pour into my family at home, get out of the redlining mode, be a better dad, better husband, and get some perspective away from the fire of the business. You know, sometimes when you're just in it, you're getting burned and you can't see, you don't have enough perspective. And if I had instead taken a little bit of a sabbatical or kind of an extended vacation or something, because I was recharged, ready to go within, you know, 60, 90 days. Mm-hmm. But I had set the structure up such that, you know, I had relinquished the control of the day-to-day operations, thinking that I could get it back if and when I wanted to. And that didn't work for 4 years.
You know, obviously, you know, like I consider you the category creator really of marketing automation and a very well-known brand. Like for the entrepreneurial community on the outside looking in, listening to you tell a story, where does this fit chronologically with the rebrand and the transition of Infusionsoft to Keep? Like, was that to get out of the pain of the down market move, or was that the starting line of the down market move and then you had to re-engineer it? Like, how does this work? Because that's what we can see from outside the bottle, right?
Yeah, totally.
The brand change in the product.
Yeah, it was kind of the early to middle part of the down market. The thinking was, okay, we're going to have a simple product. Infusionsoft's the powerful product, and we'll have this simple product. And, you know, the leaders that we'd brought in really, really wanted that. And so I got behind it because I really like the keep going, keep serving, keep growing, the tenacity of entrepreneurs that Keep stands for. But what Keep is today is actually the powerful product in an easier UI and easier experience than what we had created with Infusionsoft. So the short of it is, yeah, that was in the period where we were trying to go down market.
The way that I'm picking this up, and please fact check this, is that it was almost like, right, because so the original Infusionsoft was incredibly powerful. I mean, I remember being in the forums on those days when I was building on it. There's people having like competitions about their decision diamonds and stuff. I mean, like that culture goes deep, right? It was a lot there.
Right.
And so it was like the V1 of the strategy is to just build a simpler product for a simpler market. And really what you're saying, the market demand was we just needed an easier to use, simpler product for the same market that had the same capabilities. And it's just getting that strategy right. Is that kind of
that's pretty much right. What we did is we took the simple UX that we created for Keep and we brought it to the power of Infusionsoft. Mm-hmm. And then over the past 18 months, we've been expanding the power of Infusionsoft to actually be business automation. Hmm. So it's kind of, Keep is really the combination of the power and the ease of use, but now taken to business automation.
And both products going to keep running for the foreseeable? Is that the plan?
Nope. It's all unified. It's all one now. We did that work last year to unify the product. So that was a huge part of what we needed to do to move forward. It was a big lift.
Clay, I'm curious, part of being a category creator is not only selling the solution, but you're educating on a new perspective, a new point of view. So like you spearheaded, did you recognize that early on, or did you kind of stumble your way into realizing that it's not just making the sale, but it is building an awareness and an acceptance of the problem in the first place? That there's, I remember I was a customer of Infusionsoft in my early days as an entrepreneur. And I remember one of the lessons that stuck with me was this analogy you guys use. You said, hey, most entrepreneurs are like cavemen. They wake up every day, they go out to the field, they hunt one down, they drag it back, they eat what they kill.
Yep.
Infusionsoft is going to teach you how to build a fence around the pasture. And I like Matt knows I've used this analogy many times still to this day, like that,
yep.
The shift. Did you recognize when you were starting Infusionsoft that you were going to be in the business of educating the market in addition to distributing and selling the software? Or did you did it take a while to kind of recognize the responsibility and requirement to also educate on the thought process of marketing and automation?
Yeah, great question. We did recognize the need to educate. I don't know that I would say it was from day one, but it was fairly early on. We wrote the book to say, okay, we've got to educate, teach people about the chaos. And then what we found was the more we taught, the more successful our customers were. So we just continued to teach. Now, I wouldn't say that we said, okay, to be the category creator of marketing automation for small business, we need to educate. It wasn't quite that clear at the time. It was just, hey, we got to teach and we got to educate and help people understand it. And we want to be the leaders. And so it just kind of became natural. But over time, you know, as category creation became more of a thing, more clear, more obvious, it was like, well, yeah, that just goes along with it. And and that's what we're doing now. People, I'm telling you right now, people don't really understand what small business automation is. And it's really fun what we're doing. And it's fun to be in category creation mode and innovating and the stuff that's happening. It's, you know, we're teaching, we're getting the message out and just helping people understand the realities of what happens when you grow a business and it doesn't produce what you thought it was going to, and you can't figure out quite why.
So I got a bit of a nerdy question for you on the role of automation in an early stage business or in a small business.
Yeah.
So I think quite often SaaS founders with big ambitions and dreams reach for how to make something scalable. So they're reaching for code, they're reaching for automation really early on. Matt and I and our coaching team find ourselves saying, hey, stay close to the process long enough to know, like sometimes we're thinking of how to engineer automation and scalability before we really even know that the process that we're putting in place works. So like when you are educating small businesses on the right place to start with automation, what are the signs that you're like, yeah, this is a process that we should automate, and when should you, do you need to stay close to it? So you're staying close to the customer, close to the product, and understanding how it needs to evolve. Like you've wrestled with this, the role of automation in small business much more than Matt and I have. Curious to get your perspective on when's the right time to automate and when not to.
Yeah, I love the question. And there's a couple points I'll draw out here. The first one is what you just said is exactly why it was futile to go down market in marketing, because they don't need it yet. They have not yet figured out their processes. So we spend so much time trying to help them figure it out. And the reality is when you're very new, before you get to six figures, you don't have enough of a repeatable business to be able to automate it in a meaningful way. And you're trying to figure out what that is. You're figuring out your products, your services. So that's the first point, is don't worry about automating if you're not yet to six figures, because you don't have a real business yet. I hate to say that so bluntly. I know some people will take offense at that, but you have a budding business, you have a job, you have a thing that could turn into a business, but it's not a real business yet. A real business is repeatable. So the second point is it's the repeatable things, and it's you automate when the repetition is starting to become really mundane. It's like, wait, we're doing this over and over. And, you know, in the days of marketing automation, we would say, go look at your sent box and see the emails that you're sending over and over and over. They're almost the same verbatim fricking thing. Automate that. It becomes very obvious. Oh, yeah, okay. Well, the same thing is happening inside your business with your tasks, and your people are doing it. And what happens is sometimes, I love the way you said it, Johnny, you got to stay close enough to it, because sometimes the entrepreneur will move on quickly and the employee is just doing the thing over and over and over and over. And it's like, hey, this is why businesses don't scale well, and you're adding payroll instead of profit, because you moved on instead of recognizing where the repetition was, where the mundane tasks were, where the opportunity was for automation to create the efficiency and the profit in the business. So I think the way I'd say it is you look for the repetition, and it's not like you wait around for the repetition. You're trying to create the repetition. You're trying to create the consistency. And good automation comes from good process. And so it's that repetition. You're doing it over and over. And that's what a great business looks like. It gets, there's so much consistency and repetition that it can become automated. And it's, as you guys teach really well, you get your processes, your SOPs. My message is turn your SOPs into SAPs, standard automated procedures. That's what you want.
Mm-hmm. I love it. I created this video a while ago and I'm toying around with this idea of like, we think about oftentimes the skills or ingredients of a successful founder. And the ability to build your CRM and your audit, the automation in the business, like if that's not a skill that a founder has, it becomes very costly to make changes. You just end up throwing labor at it or dealing with a broken system. So I feel like the ability to build out automation in the business needs to be a core competency, at least in the 1 to 3 million journey. At that point, maybe you find someone else on the team that loves, you know, nerding out on operations and and tooling. But man, it's really hard to get out of the day to day without some basic understanding of an automation tool. I suppose you have a similar point of view. Do you feel like this is a core competency a founder needs to have, or are you finding team members early? Is it easy to outsource this essentially?
Yeah, you said it really well. This is something that the co-founder needs to take on at least as a responsibility. It may not be what they actually do, but they've got to recognize, I don't just punt that and hand it off to somebody else because it's going to cost me so much in the long term if I don't do it. And you're exactly right. If you get to a million and you haven't done it, that's where it starts to become really problematic. That's one of the common things that we see. You know, when I talked about the stage changes at a million, a lot of times what happens is that's a 5 to 10 person company where the entrepreneur has kind of everybody reporting to them. Maybe there's sort of an office manager, team leader type thing, but generally everybody's in close proximity. It's one team and you've been able to kind of work through things without tight processes. And then you start to plateau and you get stuck there, and it's getting your processes documented and starting to systematize them, automate them, that becomes the real lift to help them go from 1 to 3 million. So you called it out perfectly in the 1 to 3 million stage. Now we try to help people understand, start doing it at 100,000. When you start to get to the six figures, there are things you can automate. You can start to automate your marketing. You can start to automate some of your sales. And so you don't have to wait till a million for sure. But you know, generally, especially once you get to about 300,000, you get to that stage. If you're not yet doing some marketing automation at 300,000, some sales automation, you're going to start to feel it. And the inefficiencies in the sales and marketing process will make it hard for you to scale to a million.
One of the common threads that I'm going to pull on that I've seen in a few of your answers, Clate, which I love, is around education, right? It's like you spun out the leadership coaching business, which is super cool. But even as recently as last week, you know, we had an in-person event and one of our head coach, Marcel Petipa, he gave a talk on professional services and their role inside SaaS. And which is something that, again, you guys have done really, really successfully over the years. I remember when I first bought an Infusionsoft subscription, it came with professional services bundled in for implementation and stuff like that. I'm curious, in the new breed of software, right, in the Keep world, is that still something you guys need to do, or is some of that education baked into the software? And like, how are you approaching educating the market? Because there's a ton of founders who are like, I just need to make my customers learn the things and get it, and then everything's cool. Like, how do you approach that now?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. So we got away from it for a time, and then we gradually have been bringing it back. And so it is included in what we do now, meaning that we need our customers to get some education and implementation of the software. And the way I would say it is, a lot of times SaaS owners, you said it really well, they want the person to understand it, know it, get it. And especially in small business SaaS, you're kind of in this in-between space where consumer SaaS is generally so easy, you don't need to do any, you know, there's no need for training and coaching, generally speaking. And enterprise SaaS has people who this is their expertise. So the thing they're putting into place, that's what they do. They know it. Small business is this in-between world where you wish people understood process mapping. You wish people understood like their sales pipeline and what it looks like. You wish people understood the service fulfillment flow in their business, but they don't. They don't have specialists who do that. And so what we've learned is that in small business, if you've got a simple tool you're offering to people, then you don't have to do the training. It starts to look more like consumer. But if you've got a more sophisticated platform, you better do some teaching in small business or else your churn's going to look really ugly because you're assuming that they have the requisite skill. And this is nothing against small businesses. They didn't start their business because they, you know, had those skills. They started the business because of the craft that they have, the thing that they do well. And so to me, it's just necessary in small business SaaS, especially if you're not just a simple tool. But if you're a platform in small business SaaS, you've got to teach, because your users don't have the, they don't have the requisite skills that you need them to have in order to be successful. So to me, customer success and the services that go along with it are just a necessary part of a small business platform.
I love it. There's all this, like, I jokingly call it the VC lore, you know, the, it's got to be like a leather bound dusty handbook somewhere. And on page 42, it says services are bad, you know, and
right.
I don't know. I mean, I think, yes, you can build services in a way that they're a distraction from the main thing. The way we teach it, you know, with SaaS Academy is just the, your professional services should be in service of your monthly recurring revenue.
Absolutely.
Right? If done right, they're going to increase activation and decrease churn.
That's right.
I love hearing it from you, man, because the more people we can get saying that out loud for their audience and getting it into early stage founders' heads that not all services are bad. You don't have to flip the switch and turn it off. It's not a zero or a one. There are ways that you can do it in service of your SaaS growth that's yep. really served the business beautifully.
That's right. Yeah. The way I say it all the time is the service revenue sustains the subscription revenue. And again, if we're in the realm of a small business SaaS platform, not a basic tool, but a small business SaaS platform, then you'll actually hurt the subscription revenue by not having any services. Now, the question becomes, what's the right mix? And I can tell you, we've run it anywhere from 20% of total revenue as services all the way down to 0.1% as services. Yeah. And our retention is dramatically better when we're in somewhere in that 10 to 15%, that range. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what I would tell people is if you're less than 5% and you've got a platform, your churn is suffering, your retention is suffering because you're not doing enough services. And then the other thing I tell people is you shouldn't be trying to make a bunch of money on the services. You want to roughly break even. If, you know, if you can make a little bit on it, great, but you also don't want to take it in the shorts. This is the big mistake that people make, is that they try to give the services for free, but then the customers don't actually consume it and do the things that you need them to do to be successful. So you got to charge for it, not because you're trying to make a bunch of money and you're trying to be greedy. It's that it's actually the formula for customer success in small business SaaS platform. You have to have some services, they got to pay for it, and that sustains your subscription at high retention rates.
I love it, man. We're fully aligned there. So I'd love to switch gears as we get towards the tail end of this. So Clayton, you've made a couple acquisitions over the years, right? How many acquisitions have you guys made?
Yeah, we've done three.
How do you think through that strategically as a CEO? You know, like our mission with SaaS Academy is to help founders create their perfect exit. And so I'm going to ask you this from two different perspectives, right? One, for how do you think of it as the acquiring CEO? And then once we riff on that for a little bit, we'll go back and talk about acquisition targets and what makes them attractive, or maybe it happens by itself. But just how do you think about this as a growth strategy? What are the risks? You know, how do things work out? What are the landmines? You know, just what are your thoughts on that, man?
Yeah. So sometimes you think, you know, we think about it as a complementary product that will add a growth vector to the business. Sometimes we look at it as a, you know, kind of a team that you want, to some people that you, you know, you've really come to like them and you think that they're really going to be additive. And so it's kind of an acqui-hire. You're hiring people and some other things come along with it. Sometimes you're looking at it from a gap that you have where you're like, it's more of a technology gap. And so it's going to accelerate something you're doing, which is similar to an add-on product, but sometimes it's more like, it's just going to be cheaper to buy that than it is to build, than it will be to. So those are some of the ways we've looked at it. We look at lots of different things. You know, we've done three and looked at far more than 10 times that, I would say. So they usually just don't work, to be honest. There's usually valuation gap is the number one reason why I think they don't work, because I think a lot of times SaaS founders think, oh, well, this company's really big, they're going to be able to pay all this money. And it's like, no, we still have our metrics we're trying to hit. We still have our investors that are requiring, you know, things. You know, in our case, we need to operate profitably. And so we can't take on a business that's burning a bunch if we're operating profitably. So there's a lot of things that go into it. But I would say generally, it's just really hard to get a deal done for valuation reasons, for culture reasons, for just technical reasons. You know, there's just a lot of reasons. I always feel like when I'm talking to somebody and I feel excited about it and they're excited about it, I think, okay, there's like a 20% chance now.
And then the wild part is, even even if that 20% pans out, it's almost like you've earned your way to the starting line, right?
Right.
And then the integration process begins, which is a bear in and of itself. You know?
Yeah, and we've done three, and I'd say one I wouldn't do again. Yeah. The other one I would, but it wasn't that great. And the third one I would do again. It's been good.
There's kind of a fork in the road when you start to get to that, like, it's somewhere between 2.5 to 5 million or so. The founders in our world have to decide, do I become the platform that mm-hmm. others either acquire or I continue building? Or was I a component of a bigger roll-up strategy that gets to the 30 million? So there's the, am I building it? Am I selling to it? I'd be curious of the ones that have worked out. And if you said, let's just imagine that a SaaS founder in SaaS Academy started the product thinking that one day it would sell to a Keep or a Mindbody, or there's so many of the right. platforms in the space that they grow their product through acquisition. And so they know that's the, when I think of my perfect exit, it's to one of these five players in the space. If they were to build the profile in the business that made it easy to bolt it on and they were ready, because I try explaining to our founders that the Clate's on the other end of the phone, there's a small window in which they're going to consider acquiring. They're at the buy or build crossroad, and it's a real finite window. So when you get that email, if you are not ready to entertain the conversation, train's going to keep moving. Mm-hmm. So be ready to entertain the conversation if that's how you see exiting. I'm curious, what makes that a slippery slope? What makes it an exciting 20%, you know, for you specifically, or you could talk just in general, because I'm sure not only have you done three, but you got, you know, colleagues and that have done multiple. So yeah, this is I'm curious, help unpack it for the founder that thinks that that's the exit path one day.
I've got one right now that is kind of we're at that 20%, right? It's like, hey, this could be good. I think this could be good. You think this could be good. And so here's what it is. It's complementary to what we do in a really nice way. And it's something that we would like to get that into our product suite, but our teams are, our developer teams are tapped. It's just, it would just be better to buy it than to build it. And they've made it pretty clear and pretty obvious how, hey, this could fit based on what some other competitors have done. And like, they know their space pretty well. And like, yeah, that we agree. You know, we've been having this buy, build, partner question about this aspect. So I think that, Johnny, the simple way to think about it is there a really clear case of how this fits in? That's the starting point. If it's like, if I have to squint and do a lot of deep thinking and try to figure out how it's going to, I just don't have time. It's like, we're going to keep moving and doing what we're doing. So the would-be acquiree needs to know, here's the case that I would make. Now, sometimes the acquirer is going to say, well, I see that, but I also see this other thing based on what we've got going on or whatever else. But if you're selling, you need to know what's the theory of the case here. You know, why does this make sense? And you got to be able to articulate it well and crisp and quickly, so that when that opportunity is kind of in the conversation, it's like, okay, this makes sense. Let's have another conversation about it. I think that's the first thing. And you don't have to necessarily, it's not about the financials or the economics at that point. It's just like the fit. You got to be clear on that. And then I think to augment that fit, you have to be able to show culturally why this is a good thing. You know, so you've got to be able to make that case, because culturally, it's one of the biggest reasons why people don't want to do deals. You can kind of see it and smell it from the beginning. You're like, that's going to be a mess. So you got to be able to make that case. And then it gets to the financials aspect of it. And like I said, a lot of times that's where it breaks down, because it's like, well, you know, we want 15X, and it's like, we're not in that world anymore. Yeah. So
I hope you get it. You just can't get it from me.
Yeah. And if you can get it, good for you. You know, that's great. I'm happy for you.
Yeah. I love the focus on the cultural side of it from the deal-making standpoint. I'm curious from the post-transaction like integration stance, you know, I kind of mentally, for me, I break it up into two sections, right? There's the technical side of the integration, you know, getting the products talking and the go-to-market. Right. And then there's the cultural side of the integration. Which one of those is harder in your experience?
That's a great question. It just depends on how close you're aligned culturally from the beginning. If you're pretty aligned culturally, then the technical side's harder. But if you're not very aligned culturally, then the cultural part will actually be the undoing of it. So
how do you vet for the cultural side?
We are big on our purpose, values, mission, and our leadership model. You know, I talk about this in the book. We hire to it, coach to it, fire to it. And so when we're doing acquisitions, we're hiring. So we hire to it. We test the purpose, values, mission. We Are they bought into our purpose to liberate and empower entrepreneurs to strengthen families, communities, economies? While they may not have articulated it that way, if it lights them up and they really resonate, and we can see that they're actually doing that kind of thing, even though they haven't maybe put those words to it, or especially if they've kind of got their own version of it. It's the purpose, values, mission, and leadership model, and we can see it when we're in that process. And so, by the way, that's why for us, it's got to be small business oriented. They have to have passion around helping small businesses grow with automation. But yeah, the short answer is purpose, PV, I call it all the time, PVM fit.
I feel like Clayton, I need to take this conversation out to the golf course real soon.
Let's do it. I love it.
But you're in the Mecca. There's all kind of, you're right in the hot spot.
I may or may not have played this morning. So that's good.
I'll leave you two to the golf because I look like I'm trying to dig a curveball out of the dirt with a baseball bat when you hit me on the golf course. So it's not my jam.
Yeah, there's one thing we didn't touch on that I would like to just say. You called it out early, Johnny, in your question about entrepreneurs doing versus leading and the payoff that they get and the way that it mires them in the chaos, because in a kind of twisted way, they feel good about coming in and saving the day, putting the fires out, solving the problems, because that's where they got their value earlier. And this is something that Dan talks about quite a bit in the book, and I've heard him talk about it other times as well. And he and I are like-minded on this. Growth is you find your value in new and higher ways, and you push yourself to it. And it's uncomfortable doing that. And the stagnation and the chaos is furthered when we keep going back to that same thing. And we've all done it. I've done it at stage changes. By the way, this happens at stage changes a lot. When I say that the people, product, and process need to change at the stage change, a lot of times the people is the leader. The CEO has got to make some adjustments. And I've certainly been, you know, have had that experience at a few of the stage changes. So the thing that I call out in the book is we've got to get really clear about the way our ego is playing games with us. And when Ryan Holiday said, ego is the enemy, it is even more true for entrepreneurs, I think, than almost anybody else, because people don't really tell the boss what needs to be said a lot of times. And the ego of the entrepreneur, it gets them to a certain place, but then holds them in places. And so, you know, I talk about the ego traps in the book. I talk about the way that ego can really cause problems for entrepreneurs. And it goes way beyond just the jumping in and solving the problem. And instead of building your people and your process to do it, to solve the problems, it's much more than that. And it really is, I think, the thing that holds back entrepreneurs ultimately. And when we can tame the ego and we can just be humble and grateful and hungry, that's where I think we have the opportunity to keep breaking through the stages of small business growth and take the business to newer and higher places. And ultimately, as Dan says, you might choose to sell the business at a certain stage, but you're kind of setting yourself up for the next thing to do the same thing. And if you're okay with that, if it's like, hey, I know that I build SaaS companies and sell them at 3 million, or I build SaaS companies and sell them at 10 million, and that's what I do, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you think you're getting frustrated and I'm going to sell this and then the next one I'm going to take to the next level, no, you're not, because you didn't learn the lessons that you needed to at the last one. And so your ego kind of plays games with you that way. And I love that you asked the question early on about that. And to me, you know, I'm constantly working on trying to beat that sneaky little ego that lives inside of me that causes problems. And if we're not conscious to it and really working at it, it'll be our undoing.
Okay, I think our audience, and certainly Matt and I, have an awareness of the role that it plays, but we're also, you know, tactical junkies here. I'm curious, like, can you take this down? What's been effective for you for wrestling with that? And are there some habits? Are there coaches? What do you do to progress in that area?
Yeah. You know, I lay out in the book the morning routine, the week, you know, morning, daily, weekly, the things I do. I have some things I recommend, and then I have kind of a very personalized version of what it is that I do. But the short of it is that we get really still and clear in the morning through our morning mastery. And then we strive for that throughout the day through a number of different techniques. And we ask ourselves, we step back and we ask ourselves, is the ego in charge right now? It's one of the reasons why Dan and I are on the same page with feedback. Because if I'm not comfortable taking the feedback right now, that's the ego speaking. And so when we practice our routines with morning mastery, and then we work at it throughout the day, then we've got a chance to not be deceived by the ego. But if we let it go for a while, and it doesn't have to take long, the ego starts to run the show. And so, yes, there are all kinds of practices we can do. I have a ton of them in the book. But in a nutshell, it is practicing your morning routines in a way where you develop that mastery and that very clear, peaceful state. And then you try to get to that during the day. Now, I will tell you, like every other SaaS entrepreneur out there, getting to that place during a crazy day is very difficult. Yeah. But as I say all the time, the name of the game in balance is not to actually be in balance all the time. The name of the game is to be striving for it so you never get too far off.
Yeah.
That's the trick. Yeah. So if we work at it with our routines and the different things during the day, then we'll tame the ego and it won't get too far amok on us.
I'll tell you, one of the things I love, I think culturally, just about where entrepreneurship in general is going, is there's such a focus now on mindfulness and, mm-hmm. Emotional regulation and mental health. Like, that wasn't the case 10 years ago.
No.
It was, school hard knocks, walking over hot coals, just be tough. And like, that's got its time and place, but it's a finite window before you got to figure out the next level to the game, which is the stuff you're talking about, Clayton. So
yeah. And especially if you're venture backed.
Yeah.
Boy, if you play that old tape and you do that old way, you will get run over. I mean, it's just, by the way, that's one of the saddest things when you see venture backed CEOs that just get chewed up and spit out by that system because of the lack of
what could have otherwise been beautiful businesses too.
Right.
You know?
That's right. Yeah.
Wild, man. Well, I think that's probably a great place to leave it. Clayton, my friend, thank you so much for hanging with us. This was amazing. I just want to ask real quick before we take off, like, where do people go to get more Clayton? Where do they go to learn about you, about book?
For me, you can go to conquerthechaosbook.com. We've got the books coming out March 6th. We got a big event next week. So conquerthechaosbook.com for more about the book. And then if you're a business owner and you're feeling like, man, I don't like doing this process stuff and, trying to figure out how to automate these things, we have a very simple process that we've done this for years and years, where we basically identify your process, help you recognize the places where time, money, resources are leaking out of the business. And then we recommend what we call our growth and freedom playbook, the three things that you should be automating to get more growth, profit, and freedom. So they can go to keep.com/playbook. Cool. If they want to see more about that and get a free session with one of our experts that take them through that process and give them a playbook, and they can go to conquerthechaosbook.com for the book.
I love it. And we will drop all those in the show notes. As always, one click away. Clayton Mask, thank you so much, my friend. This was amazing. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, Matt, Johnny, great. So fun. Been a ton of fun. Thanks so much for doing this with me.
I feel like that was a great conversation. I'm curious, what were your biggest takeaways?
Yeah, I think for me, there were a couple. I really appreciate his stance on professional services. That's just like this, I feel like I'm just on like this Mythbuster crusade to get it through people's heads that services, if they're executed properly, aren't a bad thing in a SaaS company. So I loved, hearing from someone who's been at it for a couple decades and has had a lot of different manifestations of professional services. I loved getting his viewpoint on that. Loved the focus on integrating family life and business life and the mental health focus we talked about at the end. And the fact that you can be empathetic, but also, like the levels of business and the people and, be the leader that gets the growth out of the people and out of the business that it needs without, disrespecting your people. I think, I think he really shot the gap there. It was cool.
The train analogy was awesome. Fast moving train, the understanding the growth, the levels of growth and the stages. Like, dude, I feel right now like we're in the middle of a step change, and I was feeling all like that podcast was for me.
It was a coaching call for us that we're just going to release to the world. It's perfect.
It was awesome. There's so much that landed. And I think it's just a gift to talk to someone who's done it for 20 years. Like, here's the deal. Everyone listening to this podcast, if you can do it for 20 years, if you can engineer, how do I operate today where I could say I could do this for another 20 years? I think Clayton's done that. Like, that's why the balance is important. Like, all the success comes after. I think a lot of times we give up balance to try to get success in the near term, and then we think we'll earn the time and money freedom to then create balance. But I think it's flipped. It's like, create longevity today. How can I figure out a way to do this? How do I create my day-to-day today so that I could do this for the next 20 years? And if I can set up to play that that infinite game, as so many call it, then the value creation for others will be there. The success will be there. And I don't have to give up my family, my health, or my business goals all in the way.
100%, man. I could not agree more. In it for the long haul, brother.
Good job, dude. Fun conversation.